Hello, and welcome to the Commander Theory Podcast. I'm Nick Beatman, and I'm here with my friend, Zach Mack.
Hello, theorists.
So today, we have with us a very special guest. Jason Belk is a friend of the show, and he's got a very exciting topic for us today. Jason, welcome back to the show. What are we going to be talking about today?
Thanks, Nick. Yeah, excited to be here. My topic, I'm calling it Confessions of a Brewaholic. I probably just made up that word, but how to speed up and improve your deck building. Because I know some of us might take a little too long brewing and want to make more decks. And so hopefully some of the things I've learned can help people in the ways that I've learned.
Awesome. Well, we're so psyched to get into it. Tell us a little bit about like your history with Commander, your history as a brewer. What should we know?
Yeah, I started playing Magic 4th Edition as a kid and then kind of came back to it when I moved to Reno. My friends here were playing. We started with just kind of casual at first, and then they introduced me to Commander. That was in the 2019 pre-cons. So around Eldraine is when I started playing again, and I've basically been playing nonstop since with more and more intensity, you know, buying cards, building decks, and so on. And so, yeah, my experience with Commander, we have a local play group. We have a lot of fun. We play almost every week on Friday. More recently, you know, life's gotten away a little bit, but and even during the pandemic, we played a little bit over webcam, but I also played a lot over webcam over different Patreon communities as well. So I'm playing games on a regular basis, playing with both my local play group. I've gone to conventions. That's how I met Nick and Zach in person, and playing online. So I've got a variety of different experiences, both from the people I see every week, and we've built a kind of local meta, as well as, you know, experiencing people's takes on commanders and how to play commander outside of that.
Awesome. Well, tell us about your process. So where's the starting point for brewing for you, and walk us through that.
Yeah. For me, I see, and this is something I just kind of thought of as I was preparing to think of this episode. It's not something that I even had as categories in my mind when I was building it. I was just like, oh, this is kind of how I do it. But I have these categories of a life, what I'm calling a life cycle of a deck. So if you think about decks, you know, you're going to have from your concept, your desire stage to where I have a commander, maybe a plus a few key cards. Like, oh, I really want to brew around, you know, drawing half my library in my hand and doing something with that. Or this new card just released where I can proliferate my planeswalkers as an enchantment, you know, and take extra turns. Whatever the card is that came out or card that you've discovered, that level I'd call is desire. So like we have desire, theory crafting, rough draft, final draft, and the deck is finished. And then implicitly after that, a certain number of decks are going to be taken apart for parts and then, you know, go through the life cycle again, which is why I'm calling it a cycle. For those different parts, the way I'm describing them is desire is that kind of I have a commander plus a few key cards. Then theory crafting, brainstorming is like I have 150 non-land cards in a list somewhere, whether that's on my desk or on Architect or Moxfield or something like that. So I have way more cards than I could possibly have, not even including lands. And then once we get to the rough draft stage, so we have desire, theory crafting, now rough draft. Let's say we have 110, 120 cards, including your lands. So we're getting to the point where we're whittling it down. We have a core strategy. And then after the rough draft, we go to final draft where we're down to 103, 105, somewhere around there with your lands plus your non-lands. And then finally, of course, you want to have 100 cards in your deck when you take it to your game night, unless people are counting your cards and find that 101st card. That's the overall desire, theory crafting, rough draft, final draft, the deck is finished, and then maybe eventually down the road you take it apart once you're ready to take those cards for another deck. And for that overall process, like it helps me in my mind understand where I am in the deck building process just to set my own expectations, because there might be a point in where I get to a deck to the 150 cards in a list and life gets busy and I need to step away and it's okay. You know, it's like one of those things that this thing, even though I'm talking about speeding up your deck process, I'm not saying that you have to speed run your deck process where you're trying to like pump out decks necessarily as fast as myself or the Commander Theory does. But I think there are some tips and tricks and things that hopefully I've learned and the rest of the team here can explain that will maybe improve certain areas that if you're just doing it for the first time might take you hours and hours or weeks and weeks, and then speed those down to hopefully minutes or sub an hour time. That's not to say you can pump out a deck necessarily every single day continuously, but I've been able to make fun, competitive, good decks in, I'd say, like half a day, you know, from desire to deck finished, and I'd say that's like the minimum amount. You know, if I got much less than that, basically just a complete copy and paste, which is totally fine sometimes. But even from there, I'd say half a day is probably the minimum amount of time I need to devote to it, where I'm going from the desire and getting the physical cards out. Because if you don't have to build a physical deck, that also reduces the time quite a bit.
Absolutely. You don't have to lag time on the postal service. Yeah.
The thing that I really liked about this and your setup on this was the thing that I think most Commander players can like feel and agree with, is like the entire time through this process, the desire is like the most important part, because there's always like a thing. Like I'll do that. Like when a set comes out, I'll just get a card that I know I can't use right now because I know I'll want to use it. And so that kind of just sits there and it sits in your head and you're like, okay, I know I'm going to want to use this card, but I don't know when, I don't know where. And then like one day when like the inspiration hits, that's when it's like, okay, deck time. Like I know where I'm going to put this. I have like this goal. And I think you're focusing on like that goal as the key to the deck building process and like honing in on like what that is. That's something that I think a lot of people could benefit from if they're not already doing it. You know, I'm very, very excited to keep going. So I don't know if that has anything to add before we move on, or
no, I'm ready to jump in. We got a lot to cover today, so let's get going.
Sure, yeah. And so I'm going to take each of these different sections. So the first section being desire, we have the commander plus a few key cards, and we'll dig into that a little bit further. So just because you want to build a deck doesn't mean you necessarily need to pull the trigger immediately. That you're like, okay, I saw this new commander coming out, you know, Gitrog and Thalia for the upcoming set. I want to do that. Let's do it all in one sitting, even in a few short weeks. You can have these desires. Like I've had desires for certain decks in the back of my mind, like you were saying, weeks and months and years back, where I even keep like little notes to myself where it's like, oh yeah, I totally forgot I even wanted to do that. And then something else pops in your mind. And I think that's totally a healthy thing to have, is like a backlog of ideas. And if it helps you to write that down somewhere, that's totally awesome. But I think one thing that helps, and this is something you guys have mentioned before in previous episodes, that helps a deck stay together if you're going to build it. Because I think that's one thing to keep in mind, is like if you're going to build it and put it into paper especially and devote that much time to it, you want to have it as much use out of it as possible. You know, you don't want to just take it to one commander night, spend, you know, 10 hours putting it together, play it once, and then take it apart. That's a lot of work for very little return. And so I'd say one thing is looking at what the deck is trying to do, and does it have a similar archetype or win con as an existing deck that you're already doing? You know, do you already have a Voltron deck? Not to say that you can't have more than one Voltron deck, but like, is the play pattern going to be very similar to the Voltron deck you're already doing? Are you doing equipment? Is this an equipment Voltron deck? Okay, maybe there's some overlap there. Is it the same color identity? You know, you're working at the same card pool. Is the way that you're ramping up and executing your game plan going to be the same? Is it, say, Enchantress? You know, are you just Enchantress? I think especially falls into this, because typically it's green, white, plus X, and there's only so many different Enchantress cards that are just going to make you really pop off. There's a new Enchantress card that comes out, a new commander, you're like, okay, is it really worth me having Sithis plus this new one, or, you know, whatever your existing card is? Because just my experience, you know, sometimes even though the commander might be different, if like 70% of the cards are the same and your win con's the same, like, you're devoting a lot of time to something that's going to have a very similar experience. I think that's what a lot of us are looking for when we're building new commander decks and we're trying to theorize, is looking for generating new and interesting stories, new and interesting joint play experiences between us and the people we're working with. So that's something I keep in mind, is like, what is what I'm building? How is that going to generate to the shared experience of the group? And how does that differ from the other options I have within my repertoire of existing decks?
That's a great point. Yeah, I often, when like building decks for, you know, our set reviews or whatever, the ones that I actually end up making in paper are the ones that are just most different from what I already have in my stable. So like out of All Will Be One, I built Azuri because I didn't have any sort of like counter proliferate type deck. And then I built Ixil because I didn't have anything poison built at the moment. So definitely agree with like trying to keep your play experiences distinct. I built two like Barakos decks and kind of regretted sinking so much time and equity into doing that, because I only ever play one of them and the other one just like takes up my staples and like space on my shelf and like probably not a good use of my time.
Sure. Yeah, and there's nothing to regret from that experience after you've done it, because you always learn something. But definitely, you know, trying to like, okay, you could have taken that same time and built another partner background deck that would have maybe had new experience, learned something different, and so on. Mm-hmm. So another thing is like, what are the key synergistic pieces? Are they the same? So, you know, common combo pieces like Bolas of Citadel plus Top, you know, Aetherflux Reservoir, Approach to the Second Sun, Gray Merchant Looping, you know, flinging your commander to the finish, just doing extra combats with a lot of creatures, or Aristocrat Drain and Gain. Those are all ones that just kind of came to mind that like they have very different win cons, but if you are have them in a different shell, like it still kind of feels the same. Like if I have my LS mm-hmm. Elcor deck, which I'm draining people with a lot of small aristocrats versus Lysa, Shroud of Dusk, you're still draining. Like there's enough difference there. It's like, okay, are we doing it with creatures versus are we doing it with lots of tax effects? So that's not to say that you can't have overlapping, you know, win cons or synergistic pieces, but just thinking about like, is the play pattern going to be the same or the pieces the same for yourself and the people you're working with?
That's actually something that like I really focus on. Over the years, I've made a few different like red artifact decks, but they keep printing more of them and they all play just different enough that I keep coming back to it, even though I know like what the basic... There's only so many Hedron Archives, you know, there's only so many things you can put in a red artifact deck to like give you mana or get you cards or whatever it is. But I keep coming back to it because like I do want to see like how little different pieces all fit together. So, but again, it falls into that same trap you're talking about where I do often take them apart.
And that's quickly. Fine. That's fine too if you're self-aware of that. And it's just like, I want to see what this looks like in this new environment. But to like do that in parallel, like I already have that old deck, now I'm going to do a new one at the same time. I think that makes a lot less sense is to have parallel similar ones. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's something that I've fallen into too. So I definitely get that, especially like when you're saying Enchantress, like they just always like, I would brew an Enchantress list and then be like, it's like it's like the same because they're just, you're right. There's only so many pieces.
I'm a little worried for like the Obzon Enchantress Commander because I have a Sithis deck right now. And it's like, God, I really want to play like Doomwake Giant so badly, but I'm not going to build two Enchantress decks. Yeah.
And I even thought about this problem recently when the new Elish Norn came out. I even pinged Zach. I was like, I want to build this, but I already have like your version of the Adeline deck, which is white weenies. I know it's not ETB, but there's a lot of similar overlaps. You have your two drop ETB, draw a creature, and then win con with a lot of go wide things. And so he helped kind of see, there's other ways to win with Elish Norn that are interesting that don't involve using the same set of cards that I'm already using Adeline. So another one to watch out for in this desire stage is the play pattern too linear. This is, I think, a personal preference thing, because I do see people in my play group who have a very linear decks and they win the same way week after week and they're happy with that. And so if you're happy with that, you know, make sure your play group is okay with that too. And then otherwise you're good to go. But like for, I think people who watch this pod or listen to this podcast like to do a lot more variants, have a little more kind of, you know, spice in their soup as they're moving along. And I'd say, is your play pattern too linear? Some examples would be pod decks. You know, it's like, okay, A, then B, then C, then win. You know, or two card combo decks. It's like, okay, as soon as my Heliod sees Walking Ballista, we win. And, you know, for higher power CDH decks, that's kind of expected because you're trying to reduce variance. You're trying to build your deck around the win versus, I feel like, casual high power, lower side of the high power, you know, we're looking to win, but we're also looking to have varied play experiences. We're looking to have that shared narrative where you had that cool play where you drew half your deck, or you know, you cause I don't know, all your 1/1s to be 10/10s unexpectedly or something. And I'd say that looking for that is that play pattern too linear is something that requires a bit of experience for you to visualize in your mind, looking at the combinations of cards. And so I said this is more of an advanced one, but it's something to keep in mind. It's like, okay, are the things I'm going to be doing every game very, very much? Do I require a lot of tutors to make this work? You know, is it so jank that I basically have to tutor up everything, and then having those tutors in your hand kind of gives you a tough choice of, you know, do I go for the win con and so on? So yeah, I'd say that's another one. Another one that I've seen separate than that is the play pattern going to require a lot of bookkeeping with tiny incremental actions that will make other players think you might as well play solitaire. And this is one where I've actually discovered a lot just through experience. The first one was I built a Gitrog CDH deck with Gitrog Dredge. I practiced it a ton at home to get the combos right. I brought it to the game night, and then I went off. But like, there's just so many actions to get that incremental value to get the win of, okay, now I mill three and it triggers, and then I draw one, and then I have to do this 70 more times to be able to, you know, find my win con. Where some people, you know, might have a higher tolerance for that, but like also being respectful of people's time. And that, especially with kids or families, friends, other responsibilities, you know, you want to get more games in, see more decks. Doing those types of decks, I feel like can be just something that causes people to zone out and lose the momentum of that shared narrative of the game, where you're not, everyone's not excited to watch you do 30 different with a small various sub actions that that's just my personal preference. And it was when I'm goldfishing the deck, when I'm playing on my own, if I'm noticing like, man, like my turns are taking a really long time, even when I have no interaction, to get towards the win. When I was goldfishing a Duretti deck, I was like, at least for me, I felt like it was taking too long to progress the game forward towards a winning state. Or I could be accomplishing the same tasks with a different play pattern that is going to have just as much synergy and just as much moving the game forward, but it's summarized in simpler game actions.
I really like this tip of yours. I think that it's something that I could probably implement a bit more. Like at our last game night, I noticed that like my Bracos Guild Artisan list, so it has this sort of like non-determinate combo state. Like if I get out Aggravated Assault and I have like Bracos and a big enough party and my Guild Artisan, then provided I'm able to like keep getting in safely with my commander, I can take infinite combat steps. But like just determining like, are my opponents going to block correctly? Are my like, what is each person's life total going to be at each stage? Like it ended up where like I took, I think, what, 4 or 5 extra combats, and then I just fizzled out. And like, so my turn was like incredibly long and it annoyed everyone, but I couldn't actually clinch the win. So like, I definitely got to watch for that in the future. And then, yeah, another one that is definitely a problem is like proliferate decks. Yeah. So like I mentioned earlier, I built Azuri recently. And when you're trying to proliferate as many times as you can in one turn, like you don't, when you're building the deck, you don't often think like, but like the act of proliferating in person, like in paper, is like I have to tick up all these different dice on like 4 or 5 different permanents. And so if I proliferate 4 times, like that just adds these loading screens to the game.
and those probably cause other triggers, like when you proliferate, draw a card.
Yeah.
And then maybe, okay, now my Magistrate Scepter has X number of counters. Now I want to down ticket. So it's my Planeswalker or my creature with an activated ability to remove X number of counters. And like, there's all these spinning plates that, you know, are really cool and make it really resilient. But I think that resiliency also causes sometimes our heartache. Another example in our group was somebody had Is It Partner deck with the coin flipping goblin and Sakashima. He didn't realize
Krakashima.
It was like a CDH thing. This is like when it first came out, but nobody knew any better. And a lot of people in the play group gave the person that feedback saying, hey, this is something that like it's non-deterministic. Like it feels like once you get to the state, yeah, you're probably going to win, but we don't necessarily know. And just lots and lots of flipping, lots and lots of game actions. Maybe I return the sources in my hand. Maybe I don't, all that kind of stuff. So another deck of mine that I think falls in this camp is like Lonus with Cloudstone Curio, just because. And it's probably similar to what people would see in that Bant Commander when you draw a card, when you cast a creature and put a land down.
Chulainn.
Yeah, Chulainn. Same thing with Chulainn type of thing, where if you have lots of cheap creatures and you have lots of triggers from those, that's not to say you shouldn't do that. Just be self-aware of when you're doing that, building the deck in such a way. Like in mine, I have Cloudstone Curio. So, okay, I cast my one drop. Okay, now I have a Defiler of Vigor out. Now my creatures cost nothing and I'm putting counters on everything. So I'd say one thing that helps in this regard is like building in win cons or cards that you can dig for that are just going to explode you from making lots of value to closing out the game. So it's like, okay, I'm no longer just dirtling. I'm getting to the point where I don't need to dirtle anymore. You're dead. If I'm taking this much time equity, I should be pushing towards that win rather than just hitting more and more value.
Yeah, I feel that honestly, like, so I've never built a Brago deck, but I feel like one of the reasons people hate Brago or like playing against it is very much because of that, because like it's very strong. Like Brago is like a very strong blink commander, but then the person playing Brago is like, all right, and then I flicker my Mycosynth whatever, and then I flicker my Solemn Simulant, and then I flicker this thing, and I flicker my Reflector Mage, and you have to resolve all of these triggers, and the turn is like four turns long, because if you can do that, you got your whole combat, you got that, and then you probably have like an Eerie Interlude in hand, so it's also so hard to interact with your stuff. Yeah, and then Yorion, exactly, and then so you have these like loops that you can make going with like, yeah, Yorions or like Charming Princes and things like that, and
Stryonic Resonator combo.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it ends up being that like your turn and like anyone trying to interact with you takes like three times longer than like anyone else sitting in that pod. Yep. So I think that's one of the reasons why like Brago's gotten a lot of hate. But like I don't know if people realize that's why they hate Brago. I think they're like, oh, he's so strong, but really it's like, no, he just takes a really long time to play, and he's really fun. Like, I do not begrudge anyone. Like, every time I see a Brago deck, I'm like, that is so many cards. Like, you are drawing so many cards, but it's just so long.
and to give example back to the Karkashima one, is my friend was able to shift the deck into Grixis from Izzet, and then, you know, add Vowel Smasher. So it's like, okay, if I'm casting spells, somebody's going to die eventually. And I think that's something to keep in mind is like adding, you know, ways in your commander or cards in your deck. I see other things that help too, like damage multiplication. So if you're doubling or tripling damage, things are going to move towards the end state faster, stuff like that. So the next one, and we're just to let everyone know, we're not going to spend as much time on all the steps. This is definitely one of the bigger steps, just because when you're in the theory crafting stage and before you actually start brewing, I think this is where a lot of the ideas can get filtered out. So do I have the budget and or cards already in this color identity to make this work? So I think some people kind of gravitate towards certain color identities, just generally in how they play and their personalities, and just knowing, hey, these are cards I already have in my collection. Whether I want to take a deck apart or I don't have a deck yet and they're just sitting there. That's something to consider in this theorycraft stage, is like, I have the desire and I have the cards, so it's going to make it faster for me to build it, especially when it comes to budget for there. And I personally use a lot of proxies, especially for cards that I'm sharing between decks. So this is not as much an issue for me, but it's good to keep in mind. I would say one thing is that a lot of these decks never make it past the desire stage, and that's totally fine. If they fail one of these checks, maybe later on there's cards that are going to come out that are going to help, you know, either make it less dirtily or make it more interesting or have a different win con that hasn't come out yet, you know, that will help make this maybe an existing commander more interesting.
Yeah. I think it's great to like have this stage be the one where you're most rigorous. Cause like really stopping a deck idea before you really get started on it, that's how you save the most time for sure. Yeah.
That's a really important point is, yeah, because once you get to 150 cards on the list, they didn't get on that list by accident, usually. So, yeah. You know, this first step, we don't have that list yet. This is just, I want to do this, and I have a few cards in mind. And that's definitely the best point to nip that in the bud before you're like, oh, where did my Saturday go? So the final step, and I'd say also secondly, most important to one Nick just mentioned, is also to decide on the goal of your deck in one sentence with one clear win con and one minor sub theme. I'll say that again. It's you want to decide on your goal for what the deck's trying to do in one sentence and have one clear win con and at least one, at most, one minor sub theme. And this is something that I've fallen in traps before too. Different parts of this is I don't have a clear goal. I'm like, oh, I kind of want to do proliferate, but maybe I want to do planeswalkers. Maybe I want to do extra turns. Maybe I want to do +1/+1 counters. And I try to do all of them, and now I have 300 cards. and that's what I'm saying. Also, like, you want to have at most one minor sub theme. That's not to say you can have synergies and stuff like that. But if you're like, okay, I'm trying to do all these different things at once, commander just has too large a card pool for you to really effectively do those things, and you might be able to make it work once in a while, but I think because we're working with a singleton format, you really have to have that clear goal up front, not just from a gameplay perspective, and that it's gonna feel very disjointed. You might draw the wrong half of the deck, but also from like a deck building perspective, this helps focus your energy and prevent a lot of rabbit trails that when you're going through the subsequent process of this deck, you can just refer back to this goal and say, okay, for my Sithis deck, I want to win with creature tokens and protect my board. And, you know, if I'm going down other paths where I'm trying to, you know, maybe do a combo with tapping and tapping, you know, an enchantress dork or something, that might work, but like that's a different win con. That's a different direction. It's like, what do I want to do with my deck for Slicer? I want to make Slicer as a Voltron as lethal as possible with equipment and remove any obstacles from his way. And so these are just, I'll give some other examples that I'm sure Nick and Zach have some in mind too, that when you have that focused, and you can write it out, you can put in your deck notes, but even just having that focused in your mind, this is the direction I want to go. And then if there's any sub theme along with it that way, because I think the sub themes also are oftentimes where I spend the most time dirtling in my brewing process. Yeah. If I don't have that sub theme focused in, like, oh, but I also kind of want to, do mass reanimation and also big reanimation and also small reanimation and also, you know, draw, discard, and it gets to be too many different things at once. That like the thing that keeps me at bay when I'm being specific in this is like, okay, If there are other sub themes that interest me, that's not to say I can't build future decks later on. I just have to understand for what this commander is trying to do and the thing that got me excited about in this desire stage, like what is going to help enable that the most. So that way, when I come to the game night, I'm able to do the thing that I've been wanting to do when I invest all this time in the deck, because it's not going to make yourself happy and feel satisfied if you play your deck five times and one out of five times it's able to do the thing. That's not to say we have a singleton format and yeah, sometimes things don't work out, but if your deck is too disjointed, like you might draw only one of your themes. If you have three different themes, if you're trying to do say Kirik and you're trying to do a Bola Citadel top combo, but you're also trying to do Extort and you're also trying to do Devotion, like maybe you just draw one third of the cards that you're looking for, a mixed match. And so this is where having a focus synergy and having a clear win con with one minor sub theme in mind really helps in that brewing process understand what down the road when I have these 150 cards, am I going to be able to cut more easily?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally agree with what you're saying there. I think that there's no reason you can't build two decks.
Yeah.
If you're doing Proliferate and you are getting, you're feeling a pull towards Super Friends and a pull towards +1/+1 counters, you can just make two decks. And it's likely that, like, there's another commander out there that might even be a better fit for the theme you're trying to play with, rather than the one you just started with. So, like, you know, there's so many good, like, green, white +1/+1 counter builds out there. Maybe that's the direction you want to go to allow you to play with, like, your, I don't know, your peer imaginative youth or whatever. Definitely keep that in mind. You don't have to fit everything in one deck. There's more sleeves out there. You'll be fine.
And also might be down the road that you come back to, like, okay, I've had fun with this deck and now I want to take it apart and maybe a new commander's come out and I'm able to use that sub theme in a new way, maybe in the same color identity with a new commander that came out. Okay, one example for me that happened recently was that attracts a Grand Unifier. You know, even before it became cool, I was starting to brew it and I was able to buy it before it got too expensive. And anyway, so the point is, like, I was looking at what was on EDH Rec at the time when it was first coming out. Everyone was doing blank. You know, it's like, okay, it has an ETB effect. Yes, it's really powerful to make it blank more than one. So, looking at the top 10 and pulling different non-land cards out is basically what you're harvesting from that blank effect. But what I was thinking is, like, why do I need that many cards? if I'm playing this deck correctly, and my seven drop 7/7 Death Touch Lifelink Vigilance commander comes down, and I draw anywhere from 3 to 7 cards, 3 to 6 probably, and what am I doing that needs more than 3 to 6 cards from non-land cards that I'm tutoring basically from the top of my deck? So from my perspective, when I built that deck, my focus was I want to ramp hard into Atraxa and maximize card types, get as many cards off that trigger as possible, and winning through Approach of the Second Sun. And my thinking was, like, you know, if I'm looking at the top 10 and I can choose any of the cards I want from the top of that, Approach needs to be in the top 7, and that's within the top 10. So as long as I eventually, and finding Approach can be difficult without tutors. But when you're looking at the top 10 several times over the course of the game, plus having natural card draw, you might be able to just see it already. So for that deck, I didn't put any blink effects in it. And I played it a lot on Arena for Historic Brawl. And it usually beats out the blink decks, because the blink deck is like blinking. Mm-hmm. And then they have, 14 cards in hand. They have to discard down to 7 and they're tapped out. Yeah. And I'm like, okay, and now I win. One of the other key things for that deck that helped me just in the brewing process is like adding a bunch of mana doublers, which I've kind of learned from you guys too. It's like, okay, if I have 14 cards in hand, it doesn't matter if I can't cast them. And yeah. So it's more important for me to be like doubling my mana and being able to actually cast those cards, man. So that went down a little bit of a rabbit trail, but that was just to say is that even if there's a popular archetype out there that people are doing, really think about like, what is it I'm trying to do with that win con that's going to go towards the win? Because if I just did the blink archetype when I started out, I was like, okay, so I'll have Brago and I'll have, Teleportation Circle, I have all these things, but like, what am I going to do after that point? What am I moving towards? What's the actual goal? And that's when I focused on the card types and then winning with Approach to the Second Sun.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that like the siren song of value can like pull people down a direction where they like, are clearly way ahead on resources, but have no way to win the game. And that's not really fun for everyone. Like when all your opponents know you've got it, but you can't close it out, you haven't thought enough about like how you're actually going to get across the finish line. That's not really fun place for people to be in. Better to like have the gap between like I'm winning to I've won be as short as possible so that you can move on to the next game and everyone can like have a chance at winning that next one rather than just waiting for you to figure it out.
So something I wanted to say about this process, because I know you have some more examples we could get through, but one of the reasons that I've noticed that I've been brewing with like a lot of partners and background like choosers and stuff lately is kind of because of this. So like usually a partner is like partner A and then partner B isn't so much like plan B, but like is either contributing or something, but they're mechanically different. That's one of the things just about partners and choosers and stuff. But usually when I build decks, it's kind of what you're saying. There's what do I want to do? And then partner B is kind of informing card choices after that. So like usually when I get to that 150 card stage, when I'm looking at like a big list of cards I've checked on Scryfall or whatever, I'm saying yes or no to cards because of the partner. For example, I just recently built like an Iktekic Livio, a Stalwart Vanguard. I can't remember his whole name right now, but he's the 2-mana like blink guy. He can put Aegis counters on your creature, exile them with an Aegis counter and pay 3 to tap to put all your guys with Aegis counters back. And then Iktekic is a 5-mana 1/1. When it enters, you get a 3/3 golem. But then whenever an artifact on your side dies, like you put a +1/+1 counter on Iktekic and all your golems. So like a weird token counter thing. So Iktekic was the point of the deck, and Iktekic made me go, I want to play a Selesnya tokens build. I don't want to just do Selesnya tokens because I'm just going to put Avenger of Zendikar and like, Crater. Like I can't turn the brakes on, so I don't want to just do that. So I'm going to do Iktekic. I'm going to play as many artifacts as possible, and I'm going to kill people by making my golems as big as possible. That was like the line for the list. But Livio, who is just like a pet card of mine, informed a lot of the other choices because it was like, okay, well, what other cards are going to go in here? What ramp is going to go in here if I'm making my guys bigger? Well, Rishkar is a ramp card, but he also puts counters on guys, but I can flicker him to put counters on more guys. So like, okay, so he's going to be one of the cards in the deck. Or I need removal. What's a removal spell that goes better in this deck? And I had, there's endless possibilities for removal, and you pick things that go good with both of the commanders. So that's something that I've noticed is like, I have my guiding star over here, like you're saying, and then partner B really helps like inform the choices that end up in the main list because it plays different or whatever. But I'm always looking for that North Star, like you're saying. That's always kind of like the point of what I'm trying to do. So I think this is like very, very good advice for that reason.
Awesome. And yeah, I haven't done as much with partner commanders. I have on my desk right now Gale and Candlekeep Sage. I don't have a mono blue deck right now. And so that's another thing. It's like, okay, I don't have something in this particular color identity. I already have an Izzet Spellswinger deck. And so Gale allows you to cast things based on instant versus sorcery from your graveyard with kind of a pseudo flashback. And then Candlekeep Sage allows you, when your creature ETBs or LTBs, to draw a card. And so that gives me like a good baseline. Okay, I want to both be casting instants and sorceries, and I both want to be flickering things from my deck. And so that, because there's so many different directions you could take that based on, you know, I want to make a bunch of tokens like Talaran style. It's like, no, well, if you're flickering, you're not going to be flickering tokens. So it helps kind of focus the direction of what I want to be doing that deck.
Yeah, exactly. That sounds actually really fun. I love the background. I feel like the original partners, yes, okay, sure, like they have sinned and now we have to live with it. But like new partners, backgrounds and choosers, the friends forever. Oh, so good. So wonderful.
Sure.
So anyway, derailing too much. Do you want to keep on moving? Yeah. You have some more examples, or we can get to the next section.
Yeah. I think we've gone through enough examples on that side. We'll just go ahead and move on to the next stage. So the first one was Desire, where we had our commander request maybe a couple cards. Now we're moving on to theory crafting and brainstorming. So that would be when you have 150 plus non-land cards in a list, either on your desk or on your favorite deck building site. And so to start this process, typically what I do is I'll take an existing list. And this is something that has saved me quite a bit of time. So I'll take an existing list from either Commander Theory, because both of you guys have lists on your profiles that anybody can go on and just click copy deck and boom, you have a deck. So you have a somewhat functional, probably highly functional, if it's one of your guys' deck in your wheelhouse where your lands are set. You have the right number of lands. You have probably the right ratio of ramp removal, synergy card stuff. So that for me has saved a ton of time. But I'll almost always take that list, and that's where I start adding cards from based on my collection and the cards I had in mind. Another direction to take that is going on the EDH rec average list or searching through the EDH rec deck lists. So this one is more if I have like a specific weird old card that I want to build around. And you can go on EDH Rec. You can go to on the decks tab, so you can see all the decks for that particular commander. And then you can filter by either saying, show me decks that don't have a particular card or do have a particular card. So for example, yeah, Gale Waterdeep Prodigy, it's like a kind of a CDH card where people want to just dig down to Thassa's Oracle and win, because you can cast your nastiness from the graveyard again and then exile from there. But usually that's more of the Dimir build. But what I did, because there's not that many decks on there, to try to just find the ones that be relevant, is I would say, okay, find me all the decks for Gale Waterdeep Prodigy that don't have Thassa's Oracle, that don't have Jace, that don't have Labman, that don't have these cards, you know, Moxes, Mana Crypt, things that I know that are just a totally different design of where I want to take this deck. And then that's going to give you actually a more interesting subset, or if you're maybe a budget player and you're like, okay, I want to make sure that I'm looking for cards that only a budget player, whether that's, you know, tapped rocks or tapped lands or different things that you wouldn't see in these CDH builds that get popped into EDH Rec from time to time. So that's and then of course, like I mentioned before, if you want to have, like in this one, I want to have bribery be one of kind of the fun cards in the deck. So like, okay, let me find the other Gale decks that are going to have bribery, because I know that's a card that most people are probably not going to throw in their deck, because it's a high mana value sorcery that doesn't really necessarily win you the game outright. And so I want to find other decks, see maybe what other cards, or even just take their list and then start there from brewing.
One thing I want to mention as we're talking about this stage is that I think there's a lot of good opportunities for people to save time when it comes to the steps that are kind of like always the same. Like the like non-land contents of your deck are likely to be wildly different. But I think that with your mana base, you know, outside of a couple like utility lands that might fit your deck's theme, or maybe your commander is one that like requires a very specific type of build. But for the most part, like any two decks that you're building in the same color identity are probably going to look a lot alike in terms of the mana base. And so one thing I've done is just like I've set up a spreadsheet that with like all the cycles of lands that I most commonly use, and then I'm just able to filter it by color identity, copy it all, paste it into a deck list. And then if you're somebody like me who is making a lot of decks in rapid succession, this saves a huge amount of time not having to type out your mana base every single time. So if you're a brewaholic like Jason here, consider setting something like that up for yourself.
Yeah, something I definitely should do myself. So when I'm copying for other people's decks, I typically put their link in my comments from my Archidect page just to kind of give some level of attribution. Or if somebody else sees my deck from the web crawler, that can hopefully help them see where I got it from. Mm-hmm. So another thing to do in this phase, okay, you have your base 100. Now you're going to add the cards. So for me, I look through my collection. I do scryfall searches. There's been lots of other episodes talking about this, but basically when you're doing this step, this is where you can kind of preemptively stop it from getting too out of hand, where you have 200, 300, 400 cards in your list. And so just keep your goal in mind of, okay, you know, I want to be looking for non-land cards of different types for Atraxa and winning with Purchase Second Sun. So even though all these blink cards are in the color identity and they're really cool, you know, maybe I'll have a couple of them in there just in case I want that for value, but I'm not even going to bother setting them aside from my collection because then I'm just going to put them back away again. It's going to clutter up my view. And there's something where people say, oh, you can't have too much information. It's like, well, as a human, you can have too much information to process. And then like you're going to have like visual noise when you're looking at your deck list when you have 300 cards there. And it's, you might remove cards that are actually ones that you should have kept because you're not able to see the relationships between all the things that you're trying to do. And also at this phase, when I have 150 plus cards, is I'll actually start categorizing. So I use the Archidect category templates, and this helps me a ton to kind of just see the ratios. Like, oh, I have way too many removal cards, or I have way too many ramp cards. And which ones of these are cheaper mana value? Which ones of these synergize with the rest of what this deck is trying to do? Am I trying to use artifacts? Am I trying to use landfall? Am I trying to use enchantments, you know, auras on my lands and all that kind of stuff. So this is where you can actually start recognizing where you have too many cards in certain categories. And the categories that I use personally are ramp, removal, card draw, recursion / protection, tutors, finishing the game, and synergy. And that synergy usually is the biggest kind of broadest bucket. And you might have overlapping categories with the other ones. Like you can have a synergistic piece that works with the other ones, and you can use within Archidect with multiple categories that basically allow you to add a secondary category that allows you to see visually, okay, this card is working more than one function. And that's helped me a lot, is having those categories in mind. Like, okay, I want to make sure and have a lot of synergy pieces, but I want to make sure I have all my bread and butter pieces across the board otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Maybe we'll get more into this later and as we've slimmed down the list, but I think that one thing to think about is you can sort of like use the hypergeometric calculator to figure out like how many of certain effects you want in your deck. I'll say, for example, like finishers, you don't need 15 finishers in your deck. You can, if you think you're going to end the game by like, oh, maybe turn 10 after I've seen, you know, at least 17 cards. You can use the hypergeometric calculator to figure out like, okay, if I put X number of finishers in my deck, then by the time I've seen 17 cards, I'll probably have seen one of them. And you can do that. Like, obviously ramp are the kinds of things you want to see earlier in the game, so you might run more of those compared to finishers or some other category. So keep that in mind. There are tools to tell you approximately like how many of these things you're going to want in your final build.
Yeah, and then to get on the next stage, you really need to make a ton of cuts. So you're getting from 150 cards, oftentimes without lands, to get down to what we're going to say for the next 120, including lands. So some things that help is determining your power level. Okay, so are the cards that I'm having this list, are they going to inherently supercharge the speed of my deck? Am I using Demonic Tutor, Vamp Tutor, Mystic Tutor, these 1-2 mana value tutors that are going to make my deck much more consistent and maybe change the power level, or maybe there's other components that just based on if you're doing artifacts, you know, am I able to make infinite combos? That's going to change your power level. That's to say you shouldn't do it, but just being self-aware, okay, based on the meta and the people I'm working with, that can help determine. And I have decks even within my local meta that are lower powered, higher powered, and that helps you keep in mind when you can have that conversation when you bring the new deck to the group. And then also another one I'd say here is start flagging and removing cards that are super expensive, you know, like just monetarily, I don't have this card. It's $25 or $15 or $5, whatever your budget is. It's like, this is something I kind of learned from playing Cube more recently, is like, as you're drafting Cube, you realize that like, you don't need to have like all the cards in your cube be awesome, super synergistic pieces. Like, Magic's a resilient enough game that like, if your card is castable and makes a positive impact on the board, it'll get the job done. And so like, yeah, spending, you know, $10, $20, $30 on that really cool card, you know, if you really like your deck, you know, put it on your maybe board, flag it for later, maybe this is something I want to get. But I wouldn't have that be like, I need to have this particular combo piece. It's probably another way you could build it that might help shape the direction of your build process and also like be cheaper on your budget too. Another thing I would say is make a goal for yourself each time you sit down to say, I'm going to cut X number of cards, whether that's 5 cards, 10 cards, 1 card, you know, at this point, probably more on the 5 to 10 level of cards that you want to cut. So that way, like, I'm not going to get up from my chair until I have 5 or 10 cards out of this deck. Like, even if it hurts me, I'm just going to move them to the maybe board in case I use them in the future, even though I never, almost ever move them back. Like, it makes it psychologically less damaging to take your pet cards and move them off. But at some point, you're, okay, these are cards that realistically, if I had them in my hand, it wouldn't be something that I would be wanting to use.
And of course, like, you are likely going to find another deck at some point to house those decks. If you're trying to build a lot of different archetypes, like, there will be a time for every one of your babies to see the sunlight.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. and like we said before, looking at your goal is really important in this stage, so that helps you understand where is your commander with relation to the mana value of the deck. So like, if you have a 2 mana value commander, that's different than having a 5 or 7 or 9 mana value commander. And are the cards I have in my deck, you know, competing with that slot? If I have a cheap commander that costs 2 mana and draws me cards, you know, I can probably have a lot of cheap cantrip-y things with a few high bombs that I'll dig for, versus if I have a high mana value commander, I want to have stuff under that curve so that way I can kind of build up to it and understanding, you know, am I going to get my commander out first, or are these things going to enable my commander after it's already out? So yeah, I think those are all a lot of the main ones you want to have on that phase for the 150 plus cards. And we can, I think, move on to the,
yeah,
the rough 110, 120 non-land cards in the list. You're looking at your list, and it's just a little bit over what it's comfortable for being in a deck.
Yeah. I feel like this is the stage that, like, even if people don't realize it, that they're stuck at most often. You know, they have like the 110 cards on the desk and they're looking at them like, oh no, this is the stage I see people talk about on Twitter the most, you know?
This is where people start like cutting lands when they
shouldn't. Yeah, exactly.
It's 27-2 feud.
Yeah.
So for this one, I'd say wipe out your maybe board. Architect has the feature, I know Moxfield also has the feature, in terms of creating copies and branches. Like, since I have a software background, like, it makes more sense to me to make like a GitHub, Git, you know, feature branch type of thing. But for people who don't, like, it allows you to make a snapshot of the state of your deck. And then you can go back to that state if you want to, if you feel like, oh no, I've done something terribly wrong, how do I go back to where it was before? I'd say this kind of gives you some peace of mind, is making a snapshot of your deck. Within Architect, you can hit on the history feature on the left-hand side, and it says, you know, create a version of your deck, and you can add a name to it. And that's typically what I do at this phase, is like, because those 20 cards can really make a difference in the look and feel of your deck. And maybe later on you want to go back to and tweak it. So that's one thing. And I'd say another big part that helps getting from 120 down to the next phase is testing your deck, gold fishing, you know, actually playing it by yourself. If you physically have the cards already, that's awesome. But I play the versions of my deck on the Architect play tester on my phone, usually throughout the day while I'm brewing. So not like if I'm going to take the dog for a walk, I'll click, you know, the play button, and I'll play the first 4 to 6 turns and just get a feel for like, man, I keep having these 7 drops that I can't do anything. I have lots of ramp and then my hand's empty and my commander's not doing anything, or this card, like whenever I draw it, like the other 3 cards, I always want it to see, I never see them. And so like, maybe I should take out all 3 of those cards or whatever. I feel like this is the one that I don't hear people talk about as much, and I feel has given me the most benefit in getting a feel, like an intangible feel of which cards just don't belong. Like they're cool cards, they have a home somewhere, but like, for at this point, we're down to 110, 120 cards. we have our lands in there. We have a feel for what the direction of the deck is going. And even though it hurts to take these cards out like that, that's where just playing the deck over and over again and saying, okay, in my mind, you know, I can take out this Alhamrit's Archive because I'm already drawing more than enough cards and it costs 5 mana. And if somebody blows it up, there goes my turn. Go ahead.
I'll second the importance of goldfishing. I goldfish the hell out of every deck I brew. And it doesn't take that many goldfishes, like maybe 5 or 10 before you notice the big problems and also get some ideas for cuts. Like, you know, if you see the same card twice and you hate drawing it every single time, okay.
Yeah.
It probably should get out of there. One thing I really want to note when you're at this stage of like, you know, you've got 120 cards and you're doing the goldfishing, just make sure that your land count is still proportional to where it should be. Like, you know, 38 lands in a 120 card deck is not going to give you an accurate read on like what playing the deck is going to be like. Maybe consider ticking that up so that you're still at 40% or 38%, I guess. Yeah. So keep that in mind.
And also, I'm not usually worried about fixing at this point. So at least for me, like if I'm at this 110, 120 level, I'm just worried about my land drops. And I don't even be like, okay, do I have 2 blue pips? I'm like, we can figure out the fixing later on in the process. I just want to make sure I'm hitting my land drops and I'm getting enough mana, like almost treating like Hearthstone where everything is equal in my mind.
Yeah, I think Andy from Legendary Creature, I've seen like his early drafts of decks and he just puts in like 40 of the same basic. He just doesn't even think about it like while he's doing the testing and revising. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. And also just looking at your opening seven, like you don't even have to play through turn 4 to turn 6. You could just do a bunch of like, okay, how many times do I have to mulligan to get a keepable hand? And what are those cards that I'm mulliganing? And that's not to say that you don't want to have cards for the late game, but just understanding that like how you start the game is going to affect the rest of the game. And I think this is something that like playing a lot of Arena, playing a lot of 60 card formats, like being forced to take cards down out of your hand after mulligans, you know, versus the friendly commander mulligans. I think people get kind of spoiled, like, oh, I can just mulligan 16 times to get my hand. And being forced to like actually take real mulligans has forced me to be like, okay, is my deck construction giving me the geometric calculator of what I want to be seeing in my hand most of the time? Like, you're not going to have a perfect hand every time unless you're doing CDH and like everything's just tutors and ramp. But like generally this is, I think just looking at those keyable hands, I mean, okay, I'm generally feeling like these hands are working. If not, I'm going to mark those cards as cards that I can take out. Final draft stage. So we have 103 to 105, including lands and non-lands. So it's just over the amount that you can get away with probably people noticing. Especially when people are playing a mill game and they're counting your deck. if you have the cards in paper, you know, like for me, this is, I just start thumbing through them. Like I just have it on my desk and I'm just like, almost, if anyone's seen the Marie Kondo stuff from a few years back, like, does it spark joy?
Absolutely.
And with the temperament of like, yeah, not everything's going to spark joy. Your arcane signature is not going to spark joy. I know, but like generally, like within the context of what I'm trying to do with the goal of this deck with its minor sub theme, is it sparking joy in that context? And if I saw it in the rest of the stuff, and there might be times where you don't take any cards out, but this also is important to have those, having a cut budget in your mind. But since you only have 100, you only have 3 to 5 cards probably over your limit, it's not important to have like a, I need to take a card out every time I sit down, because you might actually kind of mess up what your deck's doing if you're being too willy-nilly on what you're doing. Mm-hmm. So I think it's important to like, okay, maybe over the course of today and tomorrow, I'll take a card out and have a certain budget for yourself that I'm going to be moving this deck towards completion. And then once you've actually started playing, you've taken the game night, you can always take it back and be like, man, I really needed more removal, or I didn't have a sweeper. You know, I need to come back.
Yeah.
Like, these decks are not like set in stone. Like almost every deck I've played, like after taking the game night, like, okay, I'm going to take 2 cards out. And then even just down the road, like a new set comes out, suddenly you're going to need to find new cuts. Like these decks are always evolving.
Always even changing.
Supposed to be eternal. Like we're obsessed with this format. And that's why we're, you know, talking to a podcast about it.
A story recently. So that same deck I was talking about is like the most recent one I brewed, that Selesnya deck. Took it to game night. Friend is basically locking himself out of the game with a Glacial Chasm, which for people who don't know or need a reminder, it's a land that I think when it enters, you have to sack a land, right? That's what it is. So when it enters, you sack a land, and then it has cumulative upkeep of pay to life. But it also says you cannot take damage, basically. Like the oracle reading of the card is like you prevent all damage that would be dealt to you. So loss of life, fine, but damage, so like if they try to attack you or whatever. And I was like, oh, okay, cool, I'll just tutor for my ghost quarter. And I just like had forgotten to put any land that did something like that into my deck. Oh, this is the bird.
Yeah, this is the same game that I failed to combo off with Bracco. So I fizzled and everyone immediately killed me. And then like this guy played his Glacial Chasm. And it turns out like Bracco's was basically the only deck that could have killed him because it causes life loss.
Yeah.
So they just had to suffer through the Glacial Chasm game.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, very good. But yeah, that's exactly what you're talking about. Like, I took it out, I like had made my decisions, and then I'm like, oh, as soon as I got home, I'm like, okay, these are the cards I need to change. Like, that just is something that will always happen every time, I feel like.
Yep. And I'd say in this phase, and even in earlier ones, but just consider when you're making your cuts, what is the game plan your deck is trying to do? You know, are you looking to dump your hand out with lots of low cost reduction or low mana value things and cantrips and just burn through your deck to find that win con? And in that case, you want to have card draw that's going to be probably unconditional or scales with the size of what you're trying to do. Mm-hmm. And so things like Stinging Study, if you have a big mana value commander that you're working towards, can help you refill Recurring Insight, Windfall, Harmonize, Greater Good. The phrase I have in my head from Legendary Creature Podcast, Andy, was, you know, yelling reload, reload from Time Crisis.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what I have in my mind when I'm thinking about, like, okay, what type of thing do I want to do when I'm dumping out my hand? But on the other hand, like, going back to that Trax idea, like, if I have 14 cards in my hand, I don't need to draw another 14. Like, I just need to get the right ones. So maybe it's Maelstrom Wanderer or other stuff like that, where I want to have big threats. I'm just dropping once per turn, and I want to cut and prioritize what keep my deck, the type of incremental draw that keeps your hand full and not missing land drops, and also maybe give some filtering. So a Memory Deluge allows you, to dig four and then eight deep, or Black Market Connection gives you both card draw and option for ramp and creatures or dig through time, stuff like that. Factor Fiction, things that may not give you five cards, but they'll give you the best two of the next five or eight cards. And I think that's sometimes just as important, because if you drew six lands, it's like, okay, then you're still not progressing your game, and you're gonna have to discard down anyway.
I want to chime in because, like, you're saying Memory Deluge, like, when that card came out, I feel like people really underestimated it, because even though, like, if this is the one that I'm thinking of, let me double check real quick. Oh, okay. That one is very good. I was thinking of another one.
From Innistrad, Memory Deluge costs 4, Boo Boo 2, and instant, you can look at the top X, which is the amount of mana you spend on this, not so good on Cascade, to take two cards out and put in your hand. It has flashback, I think, for 7 or something.
Yeah, so you get to look at 7 when you flashback.
Yes,
yeah.
So I love that card. Is very good. The one I was thinking of that people, I feel like, actually sleep on, especially in Commander, is the Manifold Insights, which looks way worse than it is. Like, I've played with this card a ton now, because Memory Deluge I have played with, and I love it. Like, that card rules. But it's a Manifold Insights is from, like, Commander 2016. It's a 3 mana sorcery, 2 and a blue. Yeah, it looks really bad, but it, in practice, is not bad, like, at all. Like, I know Nick hates it, but but it's reveal the top 10 cards of your library, and then each opponent chooses a non-land to give to you. So it's like draw 3 of the worst cards from the top 10. But, like, for the most part, unless they're giving you, like, a signet or something, like, you put all the cards in your deck. So they're like, I guess I give you a Beast Within or something, you know, like, they're like, I guess I give you this, like, creature or something. So it ends up being a lot better, especially, like, in a 5-player game, it gets even better. But that's another one where, like, go for it.
Mm-hmm. Is a Guided Passage?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Where, same thing. So you, I think both these cards are great because they're 3 mana, even though they're sorceries, like, you're going to get 3 really good hits. I mean, they might be not as good if you're optimizing for, like, okay, yes, I could have tutored for the card I wanted, but for just like three mana, dig deep. I get three cards that are good enough. And
exactly,
it's a good rate, I feel like, for getting cards that are not just straight land.
I always think of Guided Passage as less a card and more like less a value card and more of like a powerful deck building tool.
Yeah,
it's always going to tell you what your worst cards are.
That's so funny. Yeah. We have a friend who is very, very into, he doesn't live in San Diego anymore, but he was very into Guided Passage. Pretty much any time he would get a chance, like a team or deck to play a Guided Passage in, it was in there, and you'd be like, all right, look through my deck for me, and you're like, oh, okay, I guess it's time. Anyway, keeping your hand full should be something you're looking to do.
Yeah, and if you're doing low mana value stuff, you just want to get bursty draw that's going to get more of your low mana value stuff, and if you're doing a big stuff each turn, getting that filtering 7-10 cards deep, or just straight tutoring for things that you want. For me, I listed some ratios here of just generally in my mind what my decks tend to look like. Obviously, they look different based on the archetypes, but for lands, I usually go 37 to 40 lands. I've definitely gone up on my land count since listening to you guys and other people recently talk about that, and it's really helped, where I'm not like on turn four stuck on two lands still. because I used to do like 35, 36 lands, but really going up to 37 to 40 lands has helped me a lot. And usually if you have enough draw, you're not getting too flooded and the games go long enough. So, and then ramp, I go from like 8 to 12. Removal, I go from 8 to 12. Card draw, I go from 10 to 14. And then I do like 2 to 5 recursion / protection pieces, whether that's board wipe protection or, you know, recur from the graveyard stuff. And I go for like 20 to 30 synergy pieces. So that way I'm guaranteed to at least have a good chunk of my deck be what my game plan is trying to do. And I found decks that are below 20 synergy pieces are either like CDH, where you're just like, I have this small combo set that I'm trying to dig towards, or the deck is like really disjointed and like your synergy is not focused enough.
Yeah, definitely sounds like you're getting into good stuff at that point, like or just like your plan isn't clear. Yeah.
And then 0 to 3 tutors depending on the deck, and then in order to 3 and 6 finish the game type pieces. Any other thoughts on that?
I think that's a pretty good template. Again, like season to taste, like ramp is going to be less important if your curve is really low. If your commander is providing like card draw from the command zone, you can probably ease up on card draw on the main deck. So just think about it, like what makes the most sense for what you're trying to do, and then like your deck specifics.
Yep. Yeah. And then one other thing I keep in mind at this point is, am I trying to be the threat, or am I trying to like stall until I can get my game plan out? Because like some decks are just like, I am just going 100 miles an hour and just dumping things and attacking, and and like everything is just pure gas. And for those, the removal, I have a lower removal count where I'm like, I'm not worried about getting rid of somebody's Rhystic Study because they're going to be dead.
Yeah, exactly.
But unless you can really pull off a whole lot of synergy, like that's one thing. Like, okay, maybe I can go lower on the removal count and just focus more on winning harder. Or some other decks, like, okay, I know my game plan is going to take a lot of setup, but I'm going to need a lot of pieces on the board in hand and the graveyard, and I need to discard. So that, like, if I'm looting to recur and all those different spinning plates type of thing, okay, I need to have more counter spells and more removal to be able to, like, make sure somebody doesn't just pop off right before I'm about to, like, actually start my game.
And also consider opportunities where your synergy pieces like can overlap with some of these other categories. Like if you can fit in, like for example, you know, there's removal spells with proliferate or that kind of thing, if that's what your deck is trying to do. Or, you know, in my morph deck, I'm able to go to run like less real removal cards because a lot of my morphs have that function. So keep in mind, like, you can expand that synergy category to swallow other things if the card pool allows it.
I think Adeline's another good example where there's just so many good 1 to 3 mana value creatures that can either remove stuff or make an impact on the board, and you're still pushing your game forward. One of the other final questions that I think of at this point is, you know, am I trying to be too cute or clever? You know, like, and it's a really subjective question check. That, you know, hopefully you can relate to it, but at least in my mind, like, am I, is this something that the deck is actually going to do? Or is this something that, like, in my theory crafting, I'm like, it'd be so cool if I could make this work and it's not part of the core game plan. And so for example, I was making Oscar deck recently where it basically Oscar is a 5-mana value Dimir guy that where you, his cost as a commander is reduced by the colorless amount based on the number of different mana values you have in your graveyard. And then whenever you discard a card, you can cast it. Basically, like, turns everything into madness. Mm-hmm. And so for the way I was building based on a variant I saw from the Nitpicking Nerds list, I was like, okay, I'm going to do big threats that I'm going to reanimate, and I'm just going to have cheap looters that are going to throw them in the graveyard and kind of dig, and then I can keep the removal in hand to kind of keep the game plan going until I find some reanimation spells and that type of thing. And so, for example, Sir Conrad seems like a great choice in the sense that, like, yeah, I'm going to be tossing things in the graveyard. It's in the same color identity. It's a good reanimation target. But on the other hand, like, Sir Conrad, if I'm not going to be, like, turning my deck over and doing 30 damage to everyone, it's just going to annoy people. And if I need to actually cast it, it's kind of expensive to cast. And it's not necessarily a better reanimation target than, like, Villas, you know, or something that's going to, like, just... If I'm going to be cheating something out of my graveyard, I don't want it to be doing like 1-3 damage per turn and then somebody uses removal on it. I want it to have a great ETB effect, or I want it to have like a really impactful thing. And when I was cutting, I was like, yeah, it works with what the deck's trying to do, but I'm trying to be too cute and like thinking like, oh, maybe I'll have all my looters out and I'll be able to just finish someone off. It's like, but realistically, it's just going to do a couple pings and then probably get removed.
Yeah, I'm definitely guilty of putting just like too many, well... I used to be really bad about putting like a lot of do nothing 5-mana enchantments in my deck that like would enhance the theme. But like when you get to the point of like where your deck's thing is just like, okay, on turn, you know, 4, 5, and 6, I'm going to play these like setup cards that don't actually accomplish anything. And then turn 7, I'm going to start playing Magic. Like that's not a realistic game plan.
Yep.
That's something that people in the Discord will come to us with every now and then. They're like, oh, I really wanted to build this guy, but it didn't do anything until turn whatever. I feel like just over the years that's something that we've seen happen a few times. So definitely something to keep in mind here, you know. The Sir Conrad one is really real because I've been like I did a culling earlier this year. I usually do a culling of all my decks and then like either rebuild them or like build new ones. And the Sir Conrad is the only one that I haven't touched. He's just sitting there because I'm like, I really liked you, but I don't know what to do with you. And it's exactly this episode is probably gonna like inspire. I'm already thinking about a bunch of stuff I'm gonna do after talking through this episode. So this was good for me, even if the listeners no, they're gonna like it too. I think this is a really good topic, but I'm excited to have gone through all this stuff. Which actually gets us to the next portion.
Yeah. Well, when to take a deck apart. So for me, like this is not like a scientific thing. What one thing is definitely like, okay, I need the cards for a new deck and there's the same color identity. Yes, that's obvious and maybe painful, but the solace I have, especially if I have my decks on Architect or Moxfield, is I can always put it back together. And I've done that on occasion where I'm like, oh, I really miss my Kozilek deck. I put it back together and played a couple times. Like, oh, that's why I took it apart. Okay. So, and I actually oftentimes make notes on my decks. Like after I played a game, I just go to my comments page and make notes myself. Like this is how the deck performed. This is kind of what it did. Mm-hmm. You know, what I want to change while it's still fresh in my mind. And then when to take a deck apart, you know, sometimes decks perform well and they're still doing fine, but like you want to do something in the same space. Like I had a lot of fun building and playing Rafine where you're conniving, you're both drawing, discarding, I have evasive flyers and I'm, you know, trying to just beat everyone down with big, increasingly larger and larger flyers. But didn't really have a clear win con. Basically you could do it in a reanimator style, but I was just focusing on maximizing the number, like we're talking about, the number of cheap creatures I could just keep dropping out, and then maybe some burst to refill my hand. And I still enjoy the deck, but basically it's in the similar space of Gix. Like I heard from your guys' podcast episode recently, I was like, man, this is really cool. And plus, I don't really have a deck that does any like super hardcore theft of other people's decks. Mm-hmm. And so that seemed like there's a lot of overlap there, you know, overlapping color identity and game plan. They're both doing evasive draw strategies while they're attacking. And Gix is a new card, and I just wanted to play with it, and I had a copy. So for me, even though I enjoy Raphine, I took it apart, and I took the cards that overlapped and the other ones you guys had from the list and tossed in some other cards. And I played it last this current weekend on our game night and had a lot of fun. I didn't win because the person who won had a Enchantress deck and they got Shroud, so I couldn't target them to get to get the trigger. But like I was still able to like do my thing and had a lot of fun with that Gix deck. And I was able to do his activation on one opponent and get a bunch of cool stuff off their deck. So I'm glad I made that shift because I could have also had fun with Raphine. But so like sometimes it's not like one is wrong and one is right. It's like they're both right, but like maybe just you want something new for now and you can always go back later if you want to.
Yeah. For me, like the pinch is typically just what staples or like how many of each copy of staples I have. Like even though I've got like one mono black Brakos list that I never play, like I'm not building any new mono black decks in paper. So I'm not like feeling the pinch there. But there have been times where I just took something apart because I needed too many pieces for something else. In a format or like in a way to play Magic where I don't have that constraint, like on Arena, the constraint is just like, what is the deck cap? Because I have 100 decks on that platform.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for Arena, like every time a new set releases, I just delete all my decks because I know I'm going to build 100 by the next set release. And then,
yeah, that's so real though. It's like, I play multiple formats too. So it's like, and then things are going to rotate or like my standard decks are bad. So it's like, all right, everything out. You know, if I liked something, I'll probably end up brewing it like similar, but maybe tweaked a little bit better and stuff like that. So it's not like usually a problem. It's more fun for me that way.
Yeah. I don't have a ton of different, you know, criteria for when to take a deck apart. I think it's subjective to everyone based on their budget and where they're at. And I think definitely your card pool is one part. And then for me, I only have so many deck boxes too, where I'm like, I want to buy another deck box. Like I'm like running out of space where to put all these decks.
That's so real.
No, that is 100% real. So like, I just carry all of them. Yeah. Like I have, those like ultra pro kind of like pleather, like magnetic flip top boxes, and they only have like so many colors. And so I don't want to like, have repeat colors. I don't want to have, like decks boxes that don't match that format. So it's just like, that's my cap right there. And really for me, it's like when I go to game night, I only bring like four decks. And if I find that I'm just never, ever bringing a deck with me to game night, it's like, well, this isn't really doing anything for me, is it?
Yeah. No, that's a good criteria. It's like over the course of 3-4 game nights, okay, which ones did I not even try to reach for?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
because it's like you only have so many decks that you can bring. And for me, that, yes, usually the same thing, anywhere between 2 and 5. And if we've had multiple game nights and maybe the meta is different, the deck's too slow, the deck's too fast, you're just not interested in the play pattern, or the other ones you just have more fun playing, and that's totally fine. And I think that's why we love this game, is that like it creates such varied experiences, and we're continually moving forward. We're continually getting new content, continually getting new cards. And like, it shouldn't be a negative thing that we're taking things apart. It's like, okay, there's this term in economics called creative destruction. It's like, in order to make something new, sometimes you need to kind of like destroy something existing to like actually progress forward.
I really think that that's true, that like the process of like destroying an old deck or like taking it apart, especially like if you're not selling the pieces, like there are some people that I know that like, they only have like one or two commander decks. When they take them apart, they sell the staples and then eventually they'll make a new deck or something like that. But I feel like for the most part and for the most people listening to this, like the experience is going to be like you keep the cards around that you're taking apart. You can come back to it just straight up. Like there are decks that I've rebuilt like 2 or 3 times over the course of my like Magic lifetime just because like it gets in your head again and you're like, you know, I actually really would like to play whatever, like Olivia deck or something, maybe I can make it nicer this time, or you know, something like that. And you just try it out and you do it. And that's I feel like the idea that something has to be forever is kind of a negative about, like, yes, it's an eternal format, but like, you are a person whose tastes change and you're going to get bored of something. And that's just how it is. I think we should embrace that and embrace like the creative side of that, as opposed to like make yourself feel bad that you're taking something apart or that it didn't work or you don't like it or something.
Like, you had good experience with the deck at that time and like celebrate those moments and and then also just realize like this is something that like was good at that time. And just like, I think we probably all in our lives moved physically from one area of town to location. Another, one city to another. It's like those friendships are never going to be the same, but you can still keep in touch. You can still have that deck list online to play test if you want, or put it back together. And you know, just understand that like, life is just continually changing based on everything around you. And that's both cards that are released that you're playing against and the speed of the format, and also the way that you as a player have evolved and how you handle just playing the game. You might be a better player and be able to handle other mechanics or other, you know, things at once.
Yeah. Like for me, the biggest itch to rebuild has, been my old Scytherix deck, which was like probably I think my first or second deck I ever built for Commander. And at the time it was just like so heinous, it was just one-shotting people left and right back but like lately I've been trying to play Ixil poison like with a lot of the new toxic cards, and it just gets so much hate, like despite not being very strong, that I've gotten this itch to like, I think it's time to show them why what can be afraid. Show them like what poison can really do, and then they'll beg me to rebuild Ixil. I think that's what's going
to happen. You show up in like an Emperor Palpatine outfit.
Yes. Yeah.
That's
or,
so
or
good.
Grand Moff Tarkin is like, they shall know fear, or I don't know.
Yeah.
But yeah, excellent, excellent points. I think we are just about at the end of our discussion here, though. Are there any last thoughts that anyone wants to bring on, like things they've learned over the course of their deck building career? Just ways people can save time. Anything to share?
No, I think.
No, I do want to say that, like when this was pitched as like the episode topic, I was really excited about it because, like, I feel like combined with like the pace of releases, combined with like the things that we try to talk about, sometimes we skip over like basic things that like me and Nick do a lot, but we just like we're doing it and not thinking about it, you know? And so this is one of the topics that like is very, very key to, I think, how both of us make decks, and I think how a lot of listeners probably approach deck building in some way. But I think taking the time to like look at it and refocus your vision, I think is very healthy and very good for like your deck building. So you don't end up with like 7 unfinished piles on your deck, on your desk or whatever, like that you can hone in on something, play it, take it apart, you know, keep on moving that way. So I was really excited to talk about this, and I feel like you really are hitting the home run on this one. This has been a good episode. We've hit on a lot of really good points, and I hope that listeners can maybe also kind of refocus and think back to like, why did I make this deck? What would I like to do with it? Or, oh, I've been thinking about building, I don't know, Magnus the Red. What do I have to do to make that, you know, something like that, you know?
So, and feel free to chime in the Discord to share, you know, different decks that the goal stage, you know, what maybe goals that you as a player have, because it helps give other people frameworks like, oh, I've never thought of making a goal in that way before.
Yeah.
I think that we always share deck lists, but like people don't often share like some of those more foundational vision setting pieces. And I think being more open about that and just explicit helps reinforce that. And then and can also create new direction. Like, oh, I've never thought of taking in that direction before.
Yeah. That's actually why I'm super, like, I have so many decks and I post so few of them online, because my problem is I always want to put that like thought process with the deck list, which takes more time than just like scanning all the cards or something and throwing it up on Archidect. Cause I want to like be like, no, this is why I made this deck. This is my thought process. These are the cards. But that takes time that I've, especially these days, have not had. But yeah, I do think like anyone listening or in CT Discord or something like that, please, like, I would love to see, like, why did you make this deck? Like, what was the thought process? What was your goal? Was it just to play, like, a single card? Was there a commander that stood out to you? Like, was there a gameplay pattern that you wanted? Like, that's really interesting to me. I love that stuff.
Well, I don't think I have anything else to share. Just to go back to, like, whether things are sparking joy for you. Are you finding, like, take a minute to, like, notice your emotional state while you're playing a deck and afterwards. Yeah. And if you're just, like, constantly feeling frustrated by a deck, like, you probably, it might be that you need to just do some more tinkering, but it might also be that just, like, this is not the right play style for you. And maybe think about that, those emotions when you're earlier in the deck building process, you can head that off.
And also just your own emotional state. Like, I've built decks in response to a certain game night. Like, someone played a deck that was really frustrating. It was like, okay, I'm going to build a stacks deck that's going to stop this from ever happening again. I'm like, I never put it to paper because I was like, man, this would actually just, like, start an arms race, or, you know, just change the vibe of the group. And, like, be aware of those things too. And that it's, like, not just the state of, like, what the deck makes you feel, but, like, maybe the feeling you have as you're approaching the deck.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I do actually want to say one last thing that you made me think about is, like, it's okay if you like to do, like, a thing and all of your decks do that thing, but, like, different. So, like you said at the very beginning of the episode, like, Voltron, like, we have friends who, like, love Voltron, and every single deck that they have is some variation of Voltron. And, like, as long as you're having fun and, like, each of those decks is sparking joy and you're not, like, struggling to play the deck, or you're like, man, like, every time I play this deck, I don't have a good time, or this happens, or it's clunky or something, like, that's great. So, like, I feel like one of the takeaways, if you don't listen to the whole episode, could be, like, you need to have a bunch of different types of decks. No, you can have one type of deck. Like, if you like spell slingers, make a bunch of, like, red blue spell slingers. Like, there's a whole bunch of different ones now. Like, just have that experience. Like, if you really love tokens, there's so many different ways you can do tokens. Like, as long as you're happy, and as long as, like, when you are building the deck, you have a good time, you're playing the decks consistently, you know, everything is healthy and moving along, it doesn't really matter that, like, you have your play style, or that you're not, like, experiencing, like, stacks and also aristocrats and tokens. Like, just play your tokens deck. That's fine.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Have fun.
All right. Well, I think we can, wrap it up here. Thanks again for coming back on the show, Jason. It's been an amazing discussion. Really appreciate you. I think if anyone wants to reach out to you, discuss these ideas further, what's the best way for folks to get in touch with you?
Sure. I'm on the Commander Theory Discord, as well as Legendary Creature Podcast one, and highly recommend, you know, join the Patreon to support these guys. And then on Twitter, Reno Belk, R-E-N-O-B-E-L-K, and follow both these folks on there, so you can look at their follower list as well. And so, yeah, either on Twitter or on Discord, happy to chat, look at deck lists, bounce ideas off of.
Awesome. Well, this has been an awesome discussion, and I think we're going to draw it to a close, but thank you everyone for listening, and we'll be back next week with more content for you. You can reach out to me on Twitter. I'm at Commander Theory.
And on Twitter, I am at Fat Bartleby.
You can also email us at commandertheory@gmail.com. Our theme song is Lincoln Continental by Nick Cage. You can check him out on SoundCloud.
And if you're interested in some other creative products I'm working on, I have a band you can check out. We are a pink punk, pop punk band called The Have Nots, all one word, like cosmonauts. You can listen to all of our music for free right now. You can just head over to thehavenots.bandcamp.com. That is thehavenauts.bandcamp.com. And check us out. Let me know what you think.